Hey there. My name's Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table's a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is an edited version of something that we call the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with the hope that it can be a positive catalyst and encouragement to you in your own explorations. In our experience, exploring what we believe can sometimes be hard work, and we don't think anybody should have to do that alone. We're able to offer this because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond a local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. So we've been in and out of this series considering different aspects of different ideas about love for a few weeks now, and it's a big topic. It's a bit amorphous. It's hard to pin down. We've been looking at it through several different lenses, and most recently that of the relationship between love and justice. And we've had some interesting guests. We've had some interesting conversations in our own community around this. I feel like we've had occasion to be honest with one another about some aspects of this that are really challenging. And I think there's tremendous value in that. It's editorial and personal, but I don't believe actually that systems of belief or religious beliefs or faith are primarily meant to answer questions. I think they're primarily, when they're doing their best work, they keep us asking questions. They keep us seeking and exploring. And I feel like we've been doing that, sometimes in ways that really left us, I think, a little bit confounded, which I take as good news within a community. These are questions that humanity has been wrestling with, as far as we can tell, as long as we've been. And I don't think we're meant to resolve them, actually. I think we're meant to continue to wrestle with them. It's one of the things that informs our interactions with one another in helpful ways. We interact differently with one another when we believe we have the answer everyone else needs than when we believe we share the search with everyone, don't we? So, as we've been digging around in this topic in particular, the love and justice aspect of it in specific, I've been reminded of how challenging it is to hold perspectives that are other than the ones that I prefer. Now, I mean, that's not news, right? We all know that that's a tough thing to do. And most likely, we're also aware that there are plenty of, you know, culture watchers out there taking note of the fact that we don't seem to be getting better at that. In fact, it's generally taken as a given that in this part of the world, at least, we're getting worse, that our collective competencies when it comes to seeing the world from someone else's point of view are appreciably, observably in decline rather than thriving in the culture writ large. Now, we can probably pretty easily hand that off to any number of visible factors. We can hand it off to things like, you know, the big systemic baddies, things like wealth inequality or technology, maybe especially social media. We can hand that off to the increasing power corporate interests hold in our political systems and the maneuvering that happens in there. Personally, I like to blame the internet because it can't defend itself. And yes, I know I just personified something inanimate. I've always liked the word reification ever since I first ran across it. And I think I was in high school. I first saw the word in an old C.S. Lewis essay. In very simple terms, reification is when we treat something that is abstract, something like an idea, a relation between some things, a system, a quality. We treat that as though it were in fact animate, as though it were a thing. And when we treat people as though they were a thing, that's the same process. It's thingification, right? We turn something that's not a thing into a thing when we're reifying. And it seems like something we're increasingly doing with technology. I heard someone use the internet the way I just used it recently. In this case, as in the internet was responsible for people treating the author of a personal reflective essay as the object of their own feelings about the topic the person was sharing from their life about. And it felt so naturally to me in the sentence that it wasn't until a bit later that I had this sort of reflective moment to kind of go, no, that's actually really a problem. That's not okay to reify the internet. What does all of that have to do with love, and in particular with what I've referred to in the blurb this week as silent love? We're going to get to that in a moment, but I think one more sort of supporting idea first. I ran across an article this past week suggesting that we could solve our declining ability to consider one another's perspectives to meaningfully discuss and debate ideas from different points of view by choosing to teach our children rhetoric. The author called it, quote, a cheap, simple fix for our fraying social, emotional, and political health. That sounds rather appealing, no? A couple matters, though, to address before I connect that to our topic. First of all, what the heck is rhetoric? And secondly, how could learning this skill be helpful with this problem I've been talking about? And of course, what does all of this have to do with silent love? Well, this might be review for most of you, but just so we're all on the same page about a term, skill of rhetoric is the study of persuasion, and now more commonly known as the art of public speaking. That's sort of what we've substituted for the term rhetoric. Been around for a while, and sort of the Western mind, the ancient Greeks, kind of put this together as a practice. And it is potentially, at least, something that we could call a habit of connection. The skill to be skilled in rhetoric is essentially to think of others before you speak to them. Right? To be an effective communicator, you have to actually think about who you're communicating with. You have to try to get around behind what they believe and their perspective. And so to communicate effectively, we have to be able to put ourselves in the place of our listeners. And to do that, we have to listen. We have to really deeply listen to what the point is that they are trying, or in some cases failing, to make. Right? And then to respond to that thoughtfully from that perspective. That's the art of rhetoric. Now, to the connection to silent love. Simple version of a complex problem, we don't all express love the same way. And in fact, we express it in many, many different ways, influenced by things like our personalities, our upbringing, our cultural context, the prevailing norms and behaviors of those contexts, the situation we find ourselves in at a given moment, the things that we fear or that we're concerned about, and of course, how we think about ourselves and so on. So all of that kind of comes into play in terms of how we express love. Some of us grew up surrounded by love being expressed in spoken language, right? There were lots of I love yous in the air. Nobody ever left the house or said goodnight or, you know, without an I love you, right? Which is pretty fabulous in lots of ways. Some of us were shaped by situations in which that would have been a rare occurrence indeed, that articulated I love you. So let's think just for a moment about what the implications of that might be if we connect it to taking seriously an idea like love one another as you would like to be loved or as you love yourself. That idea, love one another as you would want to be loved or as you would love yourself, or do not treat others as you would not wish to be treated, that set of ideas, that's probably the most universal idea about love that we have access to. It shows up in the sacred teachings of pretty much every major religion, shows up in the philosophy of many irreligious systems as well. In my comfort zone, what I'm familiar with is lots of I love yous. And so if that's my comfort zone, if that's what I'm familiar with, that's probably how I'm going to express love for others. And it's how I'll recognize love being expressed to me. That'll resonate for me, right? If I grew up at the other extreme, let's say I grew up in an environment in which I knew I was loved, so still kind of good news in that regard, but not because anybody was saying anything about it, then that's what my love radar, not to be confused with radar love, is tuned to. Generational joke. I might even find, if I grew up in an environment where it wasn't expressed very often, I might even find that I don't trust the words themselves, and I might find them confusing if they're not expressed in other ways, if they're not connected to certain kinds of action, for example. All right, so here's what I want to do to give us a chance to consider and maybe even sort of experiment with all of this in a not quite so theoretical way, right? Not so abstract. I'm going to read us a story about this. And this is told from a cultural vantage point that in our context is probably relatively unfamiliar to all of us in the room. I may be wrong about that, but that's my best shot at it. If I missed, let me know. But it also contains elements that we're going to immediately recognize, I think, that are fairly universal. It is in the form of a personal essay, fairly recent one. This was written on March the 5th, or published on March the 5th. And as much as we're able, I would encourage us to listen to this with minds and hearts that are open to the perspective and experience of the storyteller. It is a personal story. The story is called My Father's Quiet Love Speaks Louder Than Words. The author is Lorgia Garcia Pena. Dr. Pena is a writer, an activist, a scholar. She specializes in Latinx studies with a particular focus on Black Latina dads. If you don't already kind of get the idea that we're in a cultural space that most of us don't live in, I had to look up what Black Latina dads is for sure. I was like, what in the world? Anyway, I'll leave that to you. This is the story, her story. My dad and I were once invincible dominoes partners. I was his frente and he was my compinche. I was my wingman. When the domino table materialized at that time of the night at our family parties, he scanned the room looking for me until we locked eyes. I am not competitive, but I was driven to win, if only to see the fire in his eyes. The thrill of the domino smack on the table as my soft-spoken pappy yelled, "Capicua!" He just knew he killed it. We are not close in the way some families are. We don't tell each other secrets. When he was still physically able, my dad did not show his affection by way of hugs or saying, "I love you." Ours is a tacit, unspoken understanding that we've got each other's backs. When I was younger, he'd show his care and complicity by bringing me toasted peanuts or fixing my toys. Later, he'd slip out at the crack of dawn to clean my filthy car and fill up the tank before every trip back to Boston. My favorite moments were Papi and me in the kitchen, eating roasted batata and warm cafe con leche, talking politics and history before the rest of the household stirred. The mornings were always ours. But when I was a teenager growing up in New Jersey, his unspoken love made me feel even more lonely in a family that always felt a little foreign to me. I come from a loud Pentecostal Dominican family, and we were quick to dispense advice and gossip, often while shouting over one another, but we rarely say things like, "I love you," or "I am gay." The important stuff goes unsaid. I longed for the kind of dialogue I read in novels or saw in films in which people shared their deepest fears and secrets and came out on the other side of the conversation feeling complete and warm. I envied my family's faith, especially my dad's unwavering belief that all that happens in the world, whether good or bad, was predetermined, part of God's plan. I do not believe in God the way he did. I felt abandoned, estranged, missing out on the complicity that gave him solace. I did not put my trust in an invisible man in the sky, but I did crave putting that trust in the people around me. I wanted them, not God, to be my plan. I longed to move away, to become independent and spread my wings away from my parents' watchful eyes. My family was part of a wave of Dominicans who migrated to the Northeast in the 1980s and 90s. By then, instead of murdering and imprisoning people, Joaquin Balaguer's regime was killing Dominicans via hunger and unemployment. Balaguer spent an estimated $250 million to build a massive lighthouse dedicated to the 500th anniversary of Columbus's so-called discovery of the Americas. My parents, who were in their 40s at the time, were laid off from their jobs when he cut public funding to build his beloved lighthouse. Considered too old to be employable and unable to see a future for themselves or us, they decided to leave. My siblings, and they moved to the U.S., this is from that perspective. My siblings married and moved out of our parents' home within a year of my rejoining the family in Trenton. Suddenly, I went from being the fourth child in a loud, bustling family to being a sort of only child of middle-aged, non-English-speaking immigrants. And my dad went from being the patriarch, a deacon in his church, and one of the most respected and known citizens of his town to a man who depended on his 14-year-old kid to write checks, make phone calls to utility companies, and translate paperwork. More than anything, he longed to return. When it was time for me, the first in my family, to go to college, Pappy didn't understand why I had to leave. In the Dominican Republic, it is common to live at home while studying. He was angry, the preferred response of Dominican men to hide fear. We argued a lot those days. He wanted me near, I later understood, where he could protect me from the world. After I graduated, my parents and I became a strange unit. Even though I was living on my own, my plans were often assumed to include them. Wedding invitations would come addressed to the three of us. I became accustomed to considering my parents, to seeing them as an extension of myself, even if I did not live near them. My father's love spilled over to those I loved, kid, partner, friends, students. And when I got knocked up shortly after finishing my graduate studies, I was embarrassed to have to come back home again, this time with another life inside of me. My childhood bedroom awaited me with warm blankets and gifts. My son was born in their bed, in their home, within the warmth of the security blanket they had knitted for me over the years. Later, when I got divorced, my parents, together, helped raise him, reminding me, and this time yes, now with words in addition to actions, that I was not alone. And when I was fired from a job at Harvard, my dad reminded me that in their home, there would always be enough arroz cam habichuela to go around. You will always have a home here, he said. His words gave me the courage to fight back. Over the past decade, our goodbyes became more prolonged as my mom grew grayer and as my dad's embrace grew weaker and more trembly. Two major surgeries, a debilitating illness, and diabetes complications have weakened his muscles and memory, but not his spirit. But when he suffered a massive stroke this year, doctors told us nothing more could be done. He can no longer speak. He is too weak to walk or eat. But he won't go gentle in his sleep either. On most days, I accompany him and hold his hand and read his Bible. I can feel his slow departure changing my DNA. When I visited him last week, his eyes were open and his face looked peaceful. The absence of pain in the dying is a beautiful gift for the living. I held his hand, stroked his bald head. I complained about the snow and the traffic. I told him about my classes, how I'm teaching gringos about Gregorio Luperon, one of the leaders in the Dominican Restoration War at Princeton, where I'm a professor of Black Latino studies. I could feel his pride. I closed his eyes and told him I would be okay. I am, after all, his baby. You are such a good father, such a good grandpa, I told him. I opened my eyes and saw he was tearing up. I could hear his voice so clearly, telling me it was all going to be okay. He wouldn't be far, just to the other side of the curtain. I cried too, with gratitude for our tacit, complicit dialogue, that we could sit together in silence just a bit longer. Pretty lovely, eh? Not uncomplicated, though, is it? The evolution of the relationship in that short story strikes me as both deeply ordinary and profoundly extraordinary, really quite mysterious and wonderful. It is, in many ways, a capsule, a family capsule of what it's like to just stay in the game long enough to understand the other person's way of expressing something deeply personal and powerful from their perspective and to be able to receive it. In this case, a story of, you know, a lifetime, right? Literally. One of the characters in the story coming to the embodied end of this part of their journey. We're not going to take the time to discuss it today, but I will give us a few moments to reflect in silence, and then we'll sing together. And reflect as you reflect, of course, but my invitation would also be to consider the ways in which this story might be my story, your story, our story. The opportunity, the invitation to continue to travel with somebody whose way of expressing things is not our way, long enough that we begin to understand that it could be a way of saying, I love you, even though it's not the way we would say it. They're not loving us the way that we would love. They're loving us the way that they love. And it can be so different that we don't even recognize it as love until we endure, until we stay in the game, until we stay in the conversation, in the presence of whatever it is that they're sending, until we see the part of it that's love. Peace.